officially welcome everyone to today's CLUIN seminar. My name is Jean Balance, and I'm coming to you from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as our moderator for the Internet Seminar, which has been sponsored by the Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable, or FRTR, and the Department of Navy. Today's seminar will look at large-to-loop plumes for challenges and opportunities. And I'll be joined by a number of speakers, but I'm going to hold off their introduction for our first presenter today, who's coming to us from the Navy, Carla Hare. In the meantime, though, I'm going to go through a couple of reminder items and instructions so that everyone will be comfortable with how we'll be delivering today's Internet seminar. If you've downloaded a hard copy, I'm on the second slide, the seminar homepage slide. Just reminding everybody, in order to join us for today's broadcast, I'm going to refer you back to a registration email that you would have received when signing up. That email would have directed you to the seminar homepage, which had complete descriptions on how to actually access the materials, agendas for today's slides, an agenda for today's seminar, contact and bio information for all of our presenters, and most importantly, a button that would appear in the upper left corner that says Go to Seminar. If you check in on that button, you'll actually be able to identify yourself, the people with you, and then join us in the online broadcast environment. For those of you looking to download electronic copies of the materials, you should see links near the top as well as the bottom of the page to download the slides as PDF files. Our entire broadcast today is going to be offered online through an electronic tool called Adobe Connect. Our presenters will actually deliver their talks from remote locations, and they'll control what you see. All you need to do is simply sit back and watch as they deliver their talks. We're also going to be streaming audio online through Adobe Connect by default for all of the 300 individuals who have signed up for today's seminar. If you cannot join us for the online broadcast, we do have, again, electronic copies of the materials available to download, and you can also join us via teleconference. Though we do encourage you to try to join us for the online broadcast because it will be more interactive. All of that audio is available online through the Adobe Connect environment. If you have any problems with your online audio, the first thing I'm going to do is encourage you to first check your local volume settings. Sometimes you simply need to boost your speaker volume up or get into your sound control panel to adjust that. Sometimes using a pair of headphones can help drastically increase the audio. If that still doesn't work, use the Q&A window in the lower right corner to request the call-in information, and I'll be happy to share the toll-free number with you. For those of you joining us on the telephone lines, we have globally muted the phones, and I would encourage you to use that Q&A window to submit any of your questions, comments, or report technical problems. That Q&A window will be demonstrated in just a moment, but if you haven't noticed it, look towards the lower right corner of your screen. You should see a welcome message from me. And you can actually type up comments, questions, and report technical issues using the very thin bottom white line in the lower right corner of your screen. You can type up your comments or questions there and hit the cartoon bubble to the right and actually privately submit the comments or questions to me. We'll work with whatever questions that come in and actually hold ones that are related to the technical content until we get to designated breaks with our presenters. And then at that time, we'll read your questions out loud so our presenters can address them. Our entire seminar is being recorded and will be archived. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to provide a fully recorded seminar. You can actually just check your email for the recorded version, as we automatically email all registered attendees as soon as that archive is available. If you like the session that you're seeing today and you want to learn more about what we do, we deliver free online training like this almost every day through CLUIN, and I'd encourage you to take a look at the nearly 500 archive seminars that we currently have available on the CLUIN website. So again, just one more quick reminder, you should see a screen something like this today. You're going to see the presentation materials dynamically move here in front of you today. If you're having problems viewing the content, each one of you actually has a full screen button that appears in the upper right corner of the slide window. Looks just like this. You can click that full screen button to temporarily expand the size of the slides. If you want to turn that off and go back into the normal view, simply press full screen again. To the right, you'll see a series of windows that may change as we go through today's materials. You'll see our CLUIN sponsored by logo in the upper right corner. Just below that, you're going to see a related URLs window, which actually has a number of hyperlinks. So you can click on any one of those hyperlinks and press the Browse To button to locally open up the web pages on your own computer. If you're watching the archived version of today's seminar, those hyperlinks are still active, and you can use them to browse through our resources for today's event. And then just below that at the very bottom is the important Q&A window, which you can use to submit your comments, questions, or technical problems at any time. Simply type in your message here, and press that little cartoon bubble to the right to privately submit it. So I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's seminar. So I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to our first speaker, Carla Hare from the Navy. Carla?
Hello. Well, it's great to be here today with everyone. My name is Carla Hare. I'm with the Naval Facilities Engineering and Expeditionary Warfare Center located out of Port Hueneme, California. And I am here today representing the Federal Remediations Technologies Roundtable. The FRTR is the organization or the group that's bringing you this presentation today on large and dilute plumes. And our speakers today are Dr. Brian Looney. He's with the Department of Energy Savannah River National Laboratory, and Dr. Fred Payne with Arcadis. Let me move to the next slide. So this is what we're going to cover today, the outline for the webinar. I want to start off, first of all, by welcoming you to the seminar. We're going to have some real exciting and new information to share with you regarding large and dilute plumes and the strategies and some strategies for you to manage them. These sites, of course, tend to be the most complex, the most costly, and they're the ones that are going to be around probably for the longest. But I'm certain that our speakers today are going to have some new information for you, and they are leaders really in this field, so they should be able to give you some insightful information. We're going to be talking for about 2 hours today. I first of all do want to go over what the Federal Remediations Technology Roundtable is, give you a little information, but then we're really going to get to the meat of the technical presentations on large and dilute plumes. And first off, we'll have Dr. Brian Looney give you a definition of what a large and dilute plume is and talk to you about some of the characteristics. Both speakers are really going to talk to you about challenges and opportunities and what some of the research has uncovered. Then Dr. Fred Payne will talk to you about the subsurface contaminant distribution and plume changes and focus in on the conceptual site model and tools and strategies and even highlight this with 3 case studies. We'll break then after Dr. Payne for some question and answers, and then we'll come again back with Dr. Looney to talk about to summarize, tie things together, draw some conclusions, and give you some strategies to think about. And then we'll end again with some questions and answers. So these are the speakers and our smiling faces here. We have our bios on the CLUIN website. I've been with NAFAC for over 20 years now, and I'm the Environmental Restoration Division Director there at the Engineering and Expeditionary Warfare Center. I'm also a steering committee member on the Federal Remediations Technology Roundtable. Dr. Brian Looney, he's a senior advisory scientist with Department of Energy, Savannah River National Lab. He's really been on the forefront of developing environmental characterization and remediation technologies and has been working for over 25 years in this area. We have Dr. Fred Payne on the right-hand side. He's a senior VP and director for the technology development at Arcadis. He's well known in the field for his research and his insightfulness. He's got over 30 years of experience in site characterization and restoration, and he's written several books as well. So I'm certain you will enjoy listening to them today and learning from them today. So first off, just a little bit about the Federal Remediations Technology Roundtable. This is the group that is bringing you this webinar. They were formed 23 years ago with the purpose to collaborate among the federal agencies focusing on hazardous waste site technology transfer. So we've had over 40 technical meetings over the years in person. The topics for each meeting rotate. Recent topics we've had last year were the large dilute plumes. That was in June of 2012. We've also recently had topics on optimization, and our last meeting was on alternative endpoints as well. The group will also form subgroups to dive further into topics, and listed here are some of the topics that the group has recently been involved with. These are the agencies participating in FRTR, the Department of Defense, Army, Navy, and Air Force, and also the CERTIP and ESTCP office, the Department of Energy, Department of Interior, EPA, NASA, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And the steering committee is a group of members with members from most of these agencies, and that group works to identify what the future topics are going to be to focus on for FRTR. So we recently updated our operating principles, but have really stayed true to our purpose over the years, and that is to promote cooperation and information sharing among the federal agencies. It's really a forum for advancing remediation technologies and for working together and providing input to technical guidance. We meet semi-annually. We also have a website. This is how we share our information. We hope to benefit the entire cleanup community, so not only just the federal agencies, but also consultants and remediation contractors, site owners, and regulators. Our end goal is really to provide information on demonstrations of innovative technologies for less duplication between the federal agencies and to provide a clearer and more comprehensive picture of cost and performance data. Places to go for more information on FRTR are, of course, the FRTR website that's listed on the first bullet. This is where you can find all information and presentations, actual presentations from our previous meetings. And in fact, the June 2012 meeting where large dilute plumes was presented has all the presentations from all the speakers on that topic. You can also find the technology screening matrix there, some cost and performance case studies, information on optimization. So it's a really great place to go for resources. Also, I wanted to mention the next FRTR meeting, which is an open meeting. It's open to the public. is scheduled for November 2013 in Washington, D.C. The topic is emerging contaminants. And what we're trying to emphasize at this next meeting is the virtual participation, that really is a good viable option as well if you cannot travel to the meeting in person. But more information will be coming out about that meeting as we get closer to that. So the new initiative from FRTR are these FRTR Presents webinars. And this is the first FRTR Present webinar, and our hope is to get the most interesting and informative presentations from the in-person meetings and then repackage them and deliver them to an even wider audience. So at the June 2012 meeting, both Dr. Looney and Dr. Payne's presentations really captured the audience. There was a lot of interest in them, and so this is why now we have them participating and giving this webinar today for us. And I think even between last year and this year, there's even some new developments and new information that they've added to their presentations they're going to talk to you about. So without further ado, I would like to turn the presentation over to Dr. Brian Looney, who is going to start off by telling you about what is a large and dilute plume. And I think we're doing the transition right now. There we go.
Thank you, Carla. This is Brian Looney. I'm down in South Carolina. So as Jean said, we're all in different parts of the country. And I know I speak for Fred and myself. We're very excited about being able to talk to you today and very thankful and appreciative to both FRTR and CLUIN for their support of this presentation. So the general topic for today is large and dilute plumes of chlorinated solvents. And it would be easy to kind of fall into a trap and talk about all of the kind of negative situations, how challenging they are. But I think it's really important to always package these challenges and think about what the environment gives us in terms of opportunities. So both Fred and I, throughout the day, we're going to talk about the challenges, but we'll also try to highlight areas where science, technology, and the advancements that have been made over the last decade or two provide us some opportunities as well. And the first thing that you might wonder about is, what is a large and dilute plume? That's not a particularly scientific term. And what it really is an informal definition. A large and dilute plume, well, how large is large? And how dilute is dilute? And so this is really a terminology that grew out of some thinking that was being done in the DOD kind of ESTCP and CERTIP, the Environmental Security Technology Certification Program and Strategic Environmental Research and Development Programs, where they were identifying that these were recurring challenges around the country. And it's one of those things where if you had everybody in a room, we would all know what we were talking about, but it's difficult to put a very specific definition on it. So I took an attempt of developing an informal definition. Basically, what is a plume of relatively low concentration that extends over a large area. And then as rules of thumb, many large and dilute plume lengths are measured in kilometers or miles. So typically, in order to generate a plume that large, you would have to have a moderate to strong source that has some lifetime to it and relatively high flow and low attenuation, which we'll get into in a minute. There's our informal definition. Now, what leads to these large and dilute plumes? Here's key perspectives that were put together by the DOD CERTIP research program. What are the conditions? Well, the key things are permeable aquifers with relatively high flow rates. Typically, a large and dilute plume of chlorinated solvents has low organic carbon content and low biomass in the plume, so you have minimal bio transformation and bio breakdown. They're almost all aerobic systems where the influx of electron acceptors makes it difficult to establish and maintain reducing conditions. So you have dissolved oxygen and other electron acceptors around that are competing for anaerobic processes. Attenuation processes are generally slow, and just to put a little bit of quantitative information on that, degradation half-lives are longer than about 2.5 years. And that number comes from a paper by Liu and John Wilson from EPA a few years ago, and that's their rule of thumb for when you have a plume that strongly naturally attenuating versus weakly naturally attenuating. They're often deep, so that access is more challenging and maybe expensive, and they're often affected by mass transfer in and out of less transmissive compartments, things like clay and silt layers, or isolated zones that are outside of the active flowing plume core. So these are the characteristics, and what I'd like to do is really highlight a couple things which we'll go into mathematically a little bit later. What you have is, in essence, high flow and low attenuation, and it's really the relationship or the ratio between flow and attenuation that determines how large a plume gets in combination with how much concentration reduction is needed, and we'll go through the math of that later on. So what's the problem with these large and dilute plumes? Well, there's a desire to actively remediate and bring these sites into a more restored and useful condition where their services are available to humans and the environment. There are high costs and technical difficulties involved with the very large volumes of water and very large footprints of these plumes. They're sometimes too deep for cost-effective interdiction or containment. So for just as an easy example, they're too deep often to interdict with a permeable reactive barrier. Concentrations exceed maximum contaminant levels or drinking water standards for long time periods, both with and without treatment. Significant contaminant mass is often present in inaccessible or immobile zones, so you over time have secondary sources and persistent concentrations, so these long tails that people have talked about. And large-scale manipulation of geochemistry over the entire plume can be difficult, expensive, and undesirable. And just as a quick thought experiment on that. The idea of putting in an electron donor, a vegetable oil or lactate or whey or something like that, over a square mile and turning entire plume anaerobic is not necessarily an optimal solution, even if it was cost effective, because you in essence are turning, in most cases, crystal clear water into brown iron rich hydrogen sulfide containing water. So these are the challenges. And so what we have to do, and we try to open with these challenges, because I think what it does is it sets the stage for us to really think hard about the plumes and creatively apply our science to try to come up with some solutions. Now, I'm just going to go through a few quick examples, and I'm going to talk from the Department of Energy perspective, and I'll just show a few snapshots of plumes I have known, and one of them, and we'll return to this one several times, the M-area plume from the metals, fuel, and target fabrication area at the Savannah River site in South Carolina. It's a trichloroethylene plume, approximately 2 square miles, extending to about 200 feet deep. The initial source concentration of this plume was a DNAPL, so basically you have a strong source and a large plume. 200 area at Hanford, carbon tetrachloride, 3 square miles, extending to about 350 feet deep, DNAPL source. The northwest plume at the Paducah gaseous diffusion plant, we'll look at just some quick plume maps here in a second. Trichloroethylene, square mile, extending about 75 feet deep, starts as a DNAPL. Test area north at Idaho National Laboratory, a site where a lot of folks, Hope Lee and her collaborators, have worked up there for a while, Ryan Wymore and Kent Sorensen. Trichloroethylene, about a square mile, extending to about 350 feet deep. DNAPL. So you can see these are recurring things, and it's not just the Department of Energy. So there's lots of DOD sites, Hill Air Force Base, Tinker Air Force Base, Massachusetts Military Reservation, Tooele, Army Depot, and lots of industrial facilities. So I know EPA is working on sites in New York, the Hopewell Township site and some other sites. So here's just a few plume maps. And just to kind of quickly go through the slide, because we have a lot to present, I've put some big, bold bars on here, and the bar is about 1.60934 kilometers, or about a mile, in length, just to kind of give you a perspective. So you can see here's the M-area plume, and it's a 3D image, and once again, we'll come back to this plume several times. But you can see that here's a bar that shows about a mile on the surface of that. So you can see this plume is 1 to 2 miles in length. Same thing with the Paducah gaseous diffusion plant. Here's the northwest plume moving here. You can see this is a mile, so this plume is a couple of miles long. Here's the Hanford site, so you can see this kind of plume here. There's a mile. Test area north, it's hard to see, but the plume starts here and it goes down to right around the riding on north here. So you can see this is a mile, so that's about a mile and a half in length. So these are these large plumes that start from very high concentrations, this kind of red material in the center, slowly grading out in time and space over square miles or square kilometers in size. So what is our normal conceptual model of plumes and how they grow and attenuate over time? Well, this is information from the early work in EPA that talks about natural attenuation. And plumes, if they have any attenuation at all, go through a life cycle. What you have is a source that starts, and then the plume expands. And what happens is the source has a discharge or a what's been called a mass flux. So you have a certain number of kilograms per year coming off of this source zone. The plume continues to expand, and in the subsurface, the contaminant is subject to attenuation. That's a function of a large number of things. First of all, the strength of the contaminant, the mechanisms that are available to break the contaminant down or cause other types of attenuation. And it's typically these attenuation processes can be thought of as volumetric, so it's per volume of aquifer being contacted. So what happens is over time, the plume continues to grow until at some point the volume of the aquifer is sufficient where the attenuation that's occurring in the plume in kilograms per year approximately equal to the mass discharge in kilograms per year that are emanating from the source. That will occur for some period of time. Over time, the source will be depleted, and at some future time, then the flux decreases and the plume will shrink. So in a perfect and really optimistic world, you would move through the life cycle of this attenuation. So basically, the size of the plume is a function of primarily, once again, the flow rate and the amount of attenuation going on in the plume to where this mass balance works out. Now, another way to look at it is to help us refine our conceptual model and try to come up with creative and innovative solutions is to look at the anatomy of a plume in space. And so what has been really useful to us, and we work with our regulators using this kind of a paradigm, we divide the plume, and every plume does this. Plume as small as a mom-and-pop dry cleaner all the way up to the large and dilute plume associated with M Area or Hill Air Force Base. But you can draw these rough circle, these rough ovals, and what you have is a source zone, a kind of a primary plume, and then a dilute fringe. And each of them has a different character or personality. So in the source zone or the red zone, you have typically a Dean Apple source material, very high concentrations. The need in that zone is for aggressive technologies to limit long-term damage. So this is the idea that is implicit in the regulation that to the extent practicable, it's important to go out and get the source zone treated in a reasonably effective and efficient and early fashion, as early as possible. Material emanates from this into the green zone. This is the primary plume. The characteristics there are moderate to high aqueous or vapor phase concentrations. This is the zone where concentrations are significantly elevated above environmental treatment standards, MCLs, and drinking water standards. And then you have this dilute plume or fringe, really aggressive alternatives. In the dilute plume or fringe, the need is innovative technologies, sustainable, low-energy concepts, the green and sustainable ideas. So examples in the source zone are destruction methods, stabilization in place, heat and steam, chemical oxidation or reduction, immobilization. In the primary plume, pump and treat for gas or water, recirculation wells, enhanced bioremediation. In the dilute plume, you have natural attenuation, passive pumping, enhanced attenuation, taking some kind of action to shift the environment. So this is the conceptual model we work with and has been very effective because what happens is we'll go in with our regulators and we'll describe what our behavior is going to be in each of these zones. And then once we have our behavior decided or as at the same time in parallel with that, you can talk about, okay, that's a reasonable behavior, everyone agrees, and now we argue about, like, well, where are we going to draw exactly the line for the red zone, the green zone, and the blue zone? But it really clarifies and makes very straightforward the discussion. Now, the nice thing is that there are available technologies that EPA has studied, that DOD has studied, and that other people have put a lot of investment into that roughly match these different zones. And so what you have is this is a continuum of treatment technologies moving from left to right. And at the left, you have your source removal and treatment technologies, the red zone technologies. In the center, you have this interdiction and active remediation technologies. And to the right, you have monitored natural attenuation. And just as examples, I've put a group of technologies on the bottom that are exemplars of the different classes. And so once again, when we work with regulators, what we'll do is we'll talk about the zones at the site and our behaviors in the zones, and the behavior typically takes these technologies and tries to match it into the appropriate zone. The useful part of that is, you know, is you generally avoid things like, you know, trying to excavate this volume of material because the technology is better matched in the other zone. So finally, putting on the engineering hat and closing out this this quick introduction, so my goal is really just to introduce some of the general ideas that we're going to be exploring through the day, and then Fred's really going to dig into large dilute plumes and some experiences and case studies. But putting on an engineering hat, there's always a cost component. So in the red zone, if you notice, those technologies usually require you to kind of touch the contaminant to really get a reagent in there or get energy into the environment. So the costs are typically in dollars per cubic meter or dollars per cubic yard of material treated. So what that means is that our characterization really benefits from understanding in great detail what the structure of the contaminant is, so that we are putting our reagents or our energy into the part of the source zone that has the target contaminant. In the green zone, the treatment costs in traditional engineering units are often dollars per cubic foot of water treated or per 1,000 gallons if we want to go way back in engineering units. And so what you really have to understand is where the plume is in time and space. And Fred's going to present lots of information about the plumes have a lot of structure, and so it's important to understand how they move through these large areas in three-dimensional space. And then finally, the dilute plume or fringe, the costs, because you're in such a large volume of water, are typically in dollars per time. So we really have to come up with ideas where you have a sustainable, protective situation where you have dollars per time. One of the take-home messages that we're going to get to at the near the end is that in these aerobic plumes, the attenuation rates are slow, but they are not zero. And one of the problems that people have run into is that the traditional conservative assumption for an aerobic large dilute plume is we'll just assume that natural attenuation is zero. And there's a real problem with that, because first of all, the rates aren't in fact zero. But beyond that, by assuming zero, the plume has nothing to limit its growth in time. And so basically what you have is there's nothing that gives you any kind of perspective to know how much source and primary plume treatment is needed. And there's a real need for understanding the attenuation rates, because what you can then do is go back and start getting some quantitative perspective on how much source and primary plume treatment. So here it is in both time and space, and so you start with a source. Over time, that expands. At some point in time, either through natural attenuation and combined with actions that have taken for remediation, the plume will stabilize and then shrink, and that there's a matching of remediation technologies. And as you can see, as the plume begins to be remediated and shrink, there is a need to have a process to move and transition the technologies through time.
Brian, and, just real quick, your screen's no longer up on there.
I'm sorry, okay. I don't know what's happening. So, Jean?
Yep, I'm still here. If we could have you, there you go. Looks like you're ready.
Okay, I'm resharing my screen. Sorry about that. I don't know what happened.
And thanks to all the attendees who reported that. We appreciate that real quick correction. And, Brian, you can continue on.
Yeah, poor Jean just got carpet bombed with, like, thousands of messages. So here's the slide I was just talking about, expanding and then declining and matching with technologies. And then finally, it's really great to draw these things as ovals, but they're not ovals. And what you have is plumes change in time and space. And so here, Fred will go into this in more detail, and we will reshow some of this. But plumes have three-dimensional geometries. So here you have a plume that went in here, and it's moving as a function of where water is entering and leaving the system as impacted by the hydrostratigraphy of the unit. So, you know, remembering back to Alan Freeze's thesis as depicted on the cover of Freeze and Cherry's hydrogeology textbook, what you have is local and regional flow patterns that move plumes around. Things can vary on the plume scale, and then they can also vary on what I call the dime scale. So here we have a dime scale, and this is some of the topic where you, in essence, can load some of these zones and then have them unload over time, which causes a challenge over long time frames. And just to let you know that this just doesn't happen in groundwater, Here's just a couple of other pictures. On the left is the Mississippi River, and what we have in this case is turbidity, a contaminant going in the Mississippi River. And I just pulled this out of the literature, and you have the red zone, green zone, and ultimately the blue zone in a river, so a long linear feature. And this happens to be the Fukushima release of cesium from the Fukushima to the atmosphere and depositing on soil. And what you have, once again, the red zone, the green zone, and the blue zone moving over the island of Japan in the Fukushima prefecture. So what you see is this is a general idea of understanding this kind of source zone, impacted zone, dilute fringe. But in the case of large dilute plumes, there are particular issues and opportunities associated with the need to address that. So that's what I have for kind of a little opening, and I think we're ready to shift over to Fred at this point.
Okay. Thanks very much, Brian. And I'm calling in today from Montgomery, Alabama. I'm at the ITRC spring meeting, Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council. And a lot of the information that I'll be talking about, particularly on the characterization processes, ITRC has an active team right now that you can follow. It's the Dean Apple Site Characterization Team. And that group is working very hard to consider the next generation site characterization technologies. And a lot of the information I'll talk about will be tossed into the hopper for the ITRC. So we're going to talk about developing information, or as I call it, actionable intel from the subsurface, and using a few case studies. But it does require, or it's instructed us to do some changes in our thinking. So I'll start out by talking about higher resolution site characterization and what we've learned over the last 5 to 10 years. And I know Brian's been working on high resolution characterization a lot longer than many of us have. But our industry's in a very exciting time right now because we're getting a lot more data on the subsurface and putting a lot more flesh on the bones of our site characterizations. But that's leading us to change some of our conceptual model of the subsurface, and I'll start out talking about that. Then I'll introduce some of the tools and strategies. We don't have time to go into a lot of detail, but there are some tools that we're finding are pretty effective to help us map out these very complicated distributions that Brian was showing earlier. And then I'll get into a couple of case studies. We do have reason to be optimistic in a couple ways. One is, and I think Brian was leading into this, we're learning that aquifers have a substantial assimilative capacity, which has gone really underappreciated. And so that's one of the things, the assimilative capacity of aquifers, even for compounds like trichlor or perc that we were thinking were not degrading. And the other thing is, once we have a better understanding of the transport pathways, it gives us some opportunities to actually run remedial processes successfully, where we historically were much more pessimistic. So the new conceptual foundation is really driven by a lot of the information that we've been collecting as we've been mapping transport pathways and storage locations for our contaminants and aquifers. And it's causing us to decrease our dependence on what I call the simplifying assumptions that we started making in the range of 25 or 30 years ago when we first started addressing subsurface contamination in earnest. And so, you know, we used to talk about homogeneous isotropic systems. That was a simplifying assumption, and now we realize we really also assumed that distribution patterns would be a normal distribution or bell-shaped curve, and we now realize most of our distributions, both in hydraulic conductivities and in contaminant distributions, are log normal. That adds a little bit of complexity. We also tried to solve our problems assuming a steady state condition for our aquifers, and aquifers really don't reach a steady state. It's more appropriate to think of them as in perpetual transient state. So some of you are probably realizing already this sounds like a full employment program for hydrogeologists, and perhaps it is. So when we recast the site hydrogeology framework, what we're realizing is that the good news here is that contaminant mass transport is often going to be localized in a small portion of the aquifer cross-section. And that's the good news. It does present challenges, though, because we know that contaminants can enter storage locations along those transport pathways. And so that can cause us some problems in some cases, especially in the red and green zones that Brian was talking about. We can have mass that goes to the sideline, but then it can leach back over a long time and present us with some challenges for our remedy. Overall, though, once we've understood this problem, first of all, from a conceptual basis, we know to be looking for it, and then we've developed the tools to help us map out these transport and storage locations. That allows us to, as remedial designers, we can take advantage of these distribution patterns and be more cost-effective with our remedy. So I want to go back to this question on the foundation and talk about it in a way I haven't done before, so bear with me while I try this out. I come with a missing mass problem, and what I'm trying to do here is to frame the problem that we all faced when we first started dealing with groundwater large plume contamination decades ago. We knew that we had source mass, and we could see as we put monitoring wells along the long axis of the plume, we could see concentration declines along that axis. But for example, with trichloroperc, we'd see concentration declines in those parent compounds, but we weren't seeing decomposition products. And so this is a plan view map, a surface map. And I'm going to shift now to look at along the axis of the plume, take a look at the concentration patterns that we see. So from the source, we would see a very high concentration. And as we go down along the axis of the plume, we see a sharp decline in that observed concentration. So something's going on here, because as we go down the plume, we're not seeing the concentration sustained at the source level. We see a declining concentration. So instead of the concentration running at that source level, it's decreasing. Where is that mass going to? And I'm searching for my arrow. There it is. So why isn't the concentration along the plume staying at that source? What we actually observe typically is sharp declines as we go down the plume axis. So this is what I call the missing mass program. Where did that mass go? Why isn't the concentration along the whole length of the plume at the source? Now, we used to think that it was probably spreading sideways. And there was a conceptualization that came out more than 20 years ago, the hydrodynamic dispersivity. And so we thought, well, it must be sort of a random walk process where the concentration is declining because the plume is spreading sideways. And that was embedded in the advection dispersion equation, and we still use that as a simple way of looking at subsurface distribution. But as it turns out, there's been multiple research studies that show that we really don't have significant transverse dispersivity when we studied it in controlled situations. So what is going on here? Where is the missing mass going? So we know that there's some mass that's being attenuated by mass destruction mechanisms, but there's a lot more mass in these sites that seems to be disappearing in place, sort of hiding in plain sight. And what it comes down to is we early on were assuming that diffusion would not be a very important process, so that the chance of having contaminant diffuse from a transport pathway into lower permeability zones was not going to be significant because the distances for diffusion were too long. As it turns out, we probably missed on that assessment, and diffusion actually is a lot more important than we used to think. And the transverse dispersion, in all the cases where we've measured it carefully, turns out to be very, very low. So what it means is the missing mass, the mass that disappeared from the transport pathways, which is what we're primarily observing with monitoring wells as we look along the plume axis, this mass has actually gone into hiding, in a sense, along the transport pathway. And what we realize now is that diffusion is a significant process, and there's a lot of sorption, and there's other assimilative and destructive mechanisms that are occurring along these plume axes. So we think that in a large way, the missing mass problem is solved. We've got a number of research studies which say it's not spreading laterally. And we had overlooked the importance of aqueous phase diffusion, but now rethinking that and with some lab studies, we see that it is a significant mechanism affecting mass transport, especially over long distances that we see in these large plumes. We also realized that we can near permanently sequester our solvent contaminants and related contaminants in the lower permeability zones. And as Brian is going to discuss later, there are slow rate reactive processes that we think are probably very significant in these lower permeability zones. So we're developing an emerging understanding that the assimilative capacity of natural aquifers can be very large. So let's take a look for a minute at some of the studies that give us that sense that transverse dispersivity is very low. One of the studies that has a tremendous amount of data is from Cape Cod, the Cape Cod tracer studies, where there were three tracer injection wells, which you can see in the foreground of this photo, right in here. And a bromide tracer was injected pushed out an initial injection volume out, and then they tracked it very carefully as it headed downfield. You can see the well stickups for 656 wells, multi-level samplers over the 200-meter section of the flow path. And some of the authors and the dates of their publications are shown here. And in this case, the transverse dispersivity was 1.8 centimeters, the transverse vertical dispersivity 1.5 millimeters. For those of you who work with these numbers, you realize that these numbers are in the same order of magnitude that can be explained by diffusion, as opposed to random walk dispersivity. So this is just another view, a three-dimensional view. Along the flow path, what we see is a range of velocities that have taken the tracer from the injection point at the left side of this diagram along the flow path, with the fastest pathways being relatively shallow, and a range of velocities, slower pathways down deeper. And if we had a monitoring well screen that spanned the entire interval, instead of seeing perhaps a whole population of velocities, what we would do is we'd blend that together in a long screen well, and it would look like a large longitudinal dispersivity when really what we have is a whole family of velocities. So following the Cape Cod tracer studies, as well as work that was done by Doug McCann and others at the Borden site in the 1980s, field research is repeatedly confirming that transverse dispersivity is near zero. And this was a study that was reported by Rivett, Feenster, and Cherry that initially in 2001 with a few other follow-up publications. And what we see on the left is the metal box there is a location where a DNAPL source was embedded in the Borden aquifer. And you can see the well stickups where another highly resolved data set was gathered. And in this case, trichloromethane is running down at a velocity that actually exceeds the average groundwater velocity by nearly double. So this starts giving us the indication that transport is pretty focused, transverse dispersion is very limited, and the flow pathways are a fraction of the aquifer. And when we look at a bulk hydraulic conductivity to get a bulk velocity, that's actually going to be, in most cases, quite a bit lower than the actual transport velocity. And that's because we're averaging out both high and low permeability zones, while the transport is really focused on the high permeability zones. So we're going to come back to that in a minute. Regarding the diffusion case, studies done by Leanne Doner and Tom Sale at Colorado State University, and many people have seen the videos that accompany this, but these are sand tank experiments which helped call attention to the fact that soluble compounds, dissolved phase compounds, can migrate even into clays, even in relatively short times. So Tom Sale and his group have been working with fluorescent dye tracers in mesoscale sand tank experiment. And they've done lots of studies. And in this case, we see the early phase of an experiment where dye-loaded water is moving through the tank from left to right. And the dye is initially only in the high permeability zones. And over a two-week period when they were loading material in, dye went from the sandy zone into the clay zones, and then they continued flushing with water but stopped the dye injection. And the lower two panels show the condition of the tank after the dye was swept out of the sandy zone, and you can see diffusion drawing dye out of the clay zones to rejoin the water flow. So this is a zoomed-in picture down here. And you can see that the clay zone is still bright with the dye that it picked up by diffusion during the loading phase. And we can see the dye diffusing out and generating a streamer carrying on downstream. This was sort of a wake-up call to all of us who might have been thinking that diffusion was not likely a significant process. And so as we all started rethinking and doing calculations on diffusion, we realized that if we had an aquifer that was 10 feet thick of a very high permeability zone, it would be difficult for diffusion to get from the center of that zone. Actually have to traverse it quite a bit smaller. And so diffusion can be a very important factor. So this slide shows us a conceptual model that updates to include the effects of diffusion. And so in this case, in the upper part, we're looking at the transmissive zone. And so this is the higher permeability zone. And this is where the transport is primarily occurring. There's all phase mass transport. These zones typically don't have much sorption capacity, so we have small components of sorbed mass or adsorbed mass here. But by diffusion, we can move material into a lower permeability zone. This isn't necessarily a clay, by the way. This is simply less transmissive than the primary pathway. And if we have a well-sorted sand gravel, what's relatively stagnant may still be, in some circumstances, conductive, but it could be a clay, could be a silt, but it only needs to have about a 100-fold difference in hydraulic conductivity to act as a storage zone. And in this zone, we'll have mass stored in dissolve phase. These, in the lower permeability zones, that's where carbon sorption is typically concentrated, and this is where we can have microhabitats that actually generate bacterial or abiotic processes that will actually support destruction. And here's an example from a site where we have conductive zones, both in the top and the bottom of this figure. And this is a site where a TCE source had been removed. And we had high concentration trichlor at some point in the past in the conductive zone, but now that the TCE is lodged in a lower permeability zone, and we have effectively no TCE left in the high K or transmissive zone. So if we look at this figure, there's two lines here. First of all, this is over a 70-foot thick aquifer interval, and we've got a solid line here that's the concentration of TCE. And that's scaled on the bottom here. It's a log scale, so we can see our concentrations of trichlor exceed 1,000 micrograms per liter in this bottom 20 feet. And we have no TCE in the upper 68 or more feet. When we look at the sieve analysis on these soils, we get discrete sieve analyses at all of these intervals going down, and what we find is that we have very low silt. We're expressing the grain analysis according to the percent silt and finer. So down in the first 60 feet, we have less than 5% silt or finer, which means this is going to be a very conductive material. And as we get into the bottom 20 feet of this interval, we climb up in the 10 to 20% silt and clay range. So it's going to have a dramatically lower hydraulic conductivity, although it is still conductive in an absolute sense. But what we see here is the TCE is lodged almost entirely in this lower permeability zone. So this is an example of real site data that matches the kind of data that Tom's sales experiment anticipated from his benchtop experiments. But it also calls attention to the fact it doesn't have to be a solid clay unit to be serving as a storage location. It can actually be, in relative terms, a conductive zone, but relative to the neighboring zones, much lower in hydraulic conductivity. So let's take a look again at this permeability structure and draw a contrast between the bulk behavior of the formation and the behavior in the transport zone. So we can have a massively low permeability, and those aren't the sites where we're actually dealing with large plumes. Likewise, we can have a bulk low permeability and have thin seams of conductive material, and those sites might actually, even though they're poor or unconsolidated media, they may act a lot like fractured bedrock. The large plumes are going to be formed in situations that are more like the lower groupings down here. You're going to have moderate to high bulk hydraulic conductivity, and we're going to see momentarily here that we really have to watch the distinction between the bulk behavior of the aquifer and the behavior on the transport pathway. So to do that, I'm going to call attention to this middle zone here, where our bulk permeability is, let's say, mid-range. And we're going to talk about both the mass transfer and the transport effects. So if we compare these two blocks of hypothetical aquifer, and these are going to have the same average hydraulic conductivity, the upper and lower block, and the transmissive pore fraction are the same. It's about one-third in each case. And the groundwater transport velocity is going to be the same because one-third of the unit is transmissive. So if we had an average hydraulic conductivity indicator, an average velocity of 1 foot per day for each of these units, the actual transport is going to be focused in these conductive zones. So with a bulk of 1 foot per day, the actual transport will be 3 feet per day. Thinking back to that slide I showed you from the Rivet studies at the Borden site, they injected, or they placed a solvent source, and it was reportedly traveling at roughly double the bulk groundwater velocity. And this is how that happens. In this case, if it had been in this site, it would have traveled at three times the bulk or average groundwater velocity. And that would be true for both this upper and the lower block. So what's the difference between these? Well, it's the ability to transfer mass from the conductive pathway into the lower permeability zones on the side. So we talk about this upper unit as having a low mass transfer potential, and the lower unit has a high mass transfer potential. And it's because we have an increased exchange surface area, and we decrease the diffusion pathway. So by taking this conductive zone and splitting it into three units that total the same conductive cross-section, we've increased the diffusion ability from the high K to the low K zone by roughly tenfold. So the structure of our aquifer is going to control that mass transfer potential, both to put stuff into assimilative capacity, but also to generate back diffusion effects, which could cause the tailing that Brian was talking about earlier. So here's a synopsis of the takeaways right now. First, we have been seeing patterns that are coming out from our intensified site characterization. What we're seeing is that our aquifers are largely heterogeneous and anisotropic structure, which means we're going to need to abandon some of those earlier simplifying assumptions. Also, we're seeing extreme low dispersivities, which tell us that the advection dispersion model may not match the site conditions as well as the advection diffusion model, which, by the way, was a competing model that Gillum, Cherry, and others introduced in 1984, but it never took hold. Now we're getting data that suggests, hey, we should go back and revisit that advection diffusion model that John Cherry and others put out in 1984. Also, in our large plume conceptual model, we're seeing that transport is primarily in transmissive zones, and storage is occurring in less transmissive zones, and that the mass exchange rates are a critical factor. Some aquifers are going to put a lot more into storage than others, and that affects their assimilative capacity. Out of all this, new opportunities are arising, both in remedial strategies as well as strategies for compliance. And Brian is going to cover that in the next section. Other impacts and opportunities, as I mentioned, mass transport is often concentrated in a small fraction of the aquifer cross-section. This is an example picture developed at a site where 90% of the transport is occurring in less than 10% of the cross-section. So that tells us we have some opportunities to focus our remedies. Higher resolution sampling also is unmasking this, what we call high C, low K zones, where we have high concentration, low conductivity. And this is an example from a cross-section up at Beaver Island, Michigan, up in northern Lake Michigan. And we had beach deposits that have been laid down here, and we've got finer grain materials that constitute the storage zones. And then our transport is going to be focused in zones where we have larger particle size, but also well-sorted materials. So right here, for example, we have a zone that runs about 1 millimeter particle size that is very well sorted. It will have an extreme high hydraulic conductivity. That's where the transport is occurring. So let's talk a bit about tools and strategies. I'm going to highlight the idea that we want to separate our characterization and monitoring functions, and that's going to cause us to rethink monitoring wells. And then I'll show you a little bit of information on some of the tools that we're using to get the higher resolution characterization. First, rethinking monitoring wells. Monitoring wells are very costly, and it depends on where you're located and how frequently you're sampling, how deep your well is. But we're finding that a sensible rule of thumb for the 10-year life cycle cost of a single monitoring well is around $150,000. And in many locations, it can be much greater than that. And when we think about that life cycle cost to construct and develop the well, then we'll be monitoring it and reporting often on a quarterly basis. We may have to service the well over that 10-year period to maintain connectivity, and eventually we'll have to abandon it. That leads to a life cycle cost that, by any reasonable measure, is probably at least $150,000. And the problem is that the monitoring wells are not a very highly refined way of getting data. We can't, it blends our information over whatever the length of the screen interval is, and we're finding that the sites have variability at scales much smaller than the typical screened intervals, and it's important stuff for us to be observing that the monitoring wells obscure. So what we're doing as much as possible these days is separating the site characterization from the monitoring well construction process. So we're characterizing using some of the tools that I'll talk about shortly, and then we'll determine what the most effective monitoring well locations are, and that allows us to deploy fewer monitoring wells, and they're very well focused on the zones we need information from. And it can also we can lower the cost of our characterization and improve it at the same time. So one of the tools we're using is the hydraulic profiling tool. There's a couple tools available. Waterloo Profiler is one. We have other tools available through GeoProbe. And with this tool, what we're doing, schematically indicated here on the left, is we're pushing water down the probe out through an injection port, and we're measuring the back pressure on that and measuring the flow rate, so we get a flow-pressure relationship. And with some of the hydraulic profiling tools, we would actually be measuring pressure at points above and below the injection. And from that, we're going to get a vertical profile of the flow and the pressure, and we can use that to calculate the an estimated hydraulic conductivity. And then what we're going to do is we're going to do either mini slug tests, or we will collect sieve analysis and make an estimate of the actual hydraulic conductivity. And if we don't do that, we at least get a relative permeability for the borehole. So we also combine that hydraulic profiling with vertical aquifer concentration profiling for our contaminants. And we can do that with a screen-based approach where we push a screen in and sample at discrete intervals over short interval screens. We can also use the water loop profile, which combines the hydraulic profiling tool with sample collection. And there are a few other tools out there as well for vertical aquifer profiling. What we're doing is getting a discrete interval result that gives us confidence in our concentration profile. And as you can see from the earlier data that we showed from that site that we had 70 feet of interval sampled, that used the screened-based interval profiles, but there's tremendous variation vertically over short distances in these concentrations. We also do whole core sampling, particularly where we get into interbedded sand, silts, and clays, where a vertical aquifer profiling sample using either the water loop profiler or screens might give us no aquifer yield. Going in with whole core and analyzing, that's a circumstance where we can get highly resolved pictures without being able to draw a water sample out of that segment of the formation. So overall, we're calling it next generation site characterization, and it's allowing us to improve our characterization actually on a lower cost because we're minimizing our use of monitoring wells. And it also allows us to focus our remedies. So if we can locate the transport pathways, determine the amount of assimilation, it allows us to focus our remedies typically on a much narrower part of the overall formation. Let's take a look at some case studies then. I'm going to talk the first one, a site in the Midwest where we're mapping mass transport in a glacial outwash location. Then we'll talk about another one in the Rocky Mountain region where we're doing directed groundwater recirculation in an alluvial fan aquifer. And the final one from the Reese Air Force Base, an enhanced gradient flushing and a directed groundwater recirculation that's in the Ogallala aquifer. So the first case study here, we have a source area roughly 2,000 feet from a river. And it's a glacial outwash. We have trichlor, TCE, in it. And we used a tool that we call relative mass flux mapping to help us figure out where to prioritize the remedy in this case. So this is an example of the output from a hydraulic profiling tool. And you can see the pressure response part of it in this panel on the right. We also logged electrical conductivity. And that helps us generate a reference cross-section, just a very rough schematic cross-section of the hydraulic conductivity for the site. And this, in the longitudinal section, this is a hydraulic profile tool results on the longitudinal section with information regarding the TCE concentration superimposed. And what we see here along the axis of the plume is that we have transport apparently running deep in the formation. There is hydraulic conductivity in the upper zone, but it's not transporting contaminant. The trichlor got entrained in the lower part of the formation running just above a dense clay basement. It does curve also. You can see in plan view map. And once it gets out in to enter the river valley section, we see the plume starts to anastomose would be the geologic term here, but it starts to follow probably some braided channel features and starts getting a little bit wider in the valley fill. So we were able to interpolate between our boring locations, and this is the longitudinal cross-section map of the interpolated concentrations of trichlor. And this is the interpolated hydraulic conductivity picture, which we were able to develop with the hydraulic profiling tool in the darkly, the red zones and the green zones are the areas that are most hydraulically conductive. And this picture matches what we expected from the fluvial morphology on the site. Well, now we have a tool that you could consider for using at your sites, and that is to combine the interpolated hydraulic conductivity picture, which is here on the left, and multiply that by our concentration matrix to get a calculated relative mass flux. And this helps us put together a picture of where the mass transport is greatest, because an area that has high concentration but no permeability is going to have very limited transport. And likewise, zones that have very low concentrations but high conductivity, like this zone up here, are also not going to participate in transport. So by multiplying these two fields together, we can get this picture of the calculated relative mass flux. It helps us prioritize, first of all, locate where our mass transport is occurring and focus our remedial efforts on those zones and our monitoring efforts as well. So our second case study is in the Rocky Mountain regions. This is an alluvial fan aquifer, and the velocity here is quite high. It's literally 10 foot per day. If you put a die in, you could track it moving at 10 feet per day. And this was a mixed NAPL source, both L-NAPL and D-NAPL, and there were chlorinated solvents in that mixture. That source has been removed, and there's a groundwater extraction, treatment, and reinjection, with the groundwater extraction occurring at the site perimeter, and immediately down gradient, the cleaned groundwater is being reinjected. So what we've done here is we're controlling the recharge back into the aquifer, and clean water is flushing this nearly, this is a mile-long plume, and the washout example that I'm going to show is near the toe of this plume. And what we're going to see is that by reinserting clean water onto the flow pathway, we can wash the contaminants out of the transport channel. So remembering the pictures of the general aquifer characteristics that we looked at before, this diagram up at the top here probably represents pretty well the general permeability picture at this site. We've got relatively low permeability in the upper zone. Then we hit a zone of very high permeability in the alluvium. And again, it's underlain by a very low hydraulic conductivity zone. So it's in this zone that the transport is occurring at roughly 10 feet per day. So what we're looking here, after the clean water perfusion started, we still had high concentrations in the range of 60 or more micrograms per liter, in this case it's per. But we saw a relatively rapid washout, so that by the end of a year, year and a half, we were getting down into the 10 microgram per liter range. But then we saw a shift in the slope of our recovery curve. And so really, to get down toward the non-detect range, it took an additional 2 years to get us down into that non-detect range. And we're seeing this pattern pretty commonly, this bimodal pattern where we have what looks like an advective washout followed by a phase of back diffusion. And I think Chuck Newell and his group at GSI has reported on similar findings. So I think a number of us now who are watching these things closely, where we have a fair amount of data on systems where we're getting clean water washout going, we're seeing this might cause is going to be controlled by two things. One is the mass transfer potential of the matrix, and this is what we would call a low mass transfer potential because we've got a large bulk transport zone without a lot of interbedding. And the second thing is how much exposure time there is for contaminants to have loaded into the lower permeability zone. So this is a pretty nice picture. They're not always going to work out as cleanly as this one. Sometimes the back diffusion process can be more of a challenge. Let's shift to the case three, the Reese Air Force Base. And there were two types of technologies that were applied here. And first of all, we're in the Ogallala Aquifer, and we have groundwater velocities that in the large fluvial section we're going to talk about that range probably from 1 to 10 foot per day in the conductive zones. There was a large data zone trichlor source that that was removed before we started our work on the groundwater plume. But we did come in with an 18,000-foot dissolved phase plume. So that, by I think anybody's definition, that's definitely a large plume. And there were two different technologies that we applied on the large plume, and it was controlled really by the matrix structure. And I'm going to go into that now. Well, first of all, I'll give some more information, sorry. First, this is, overall, it's a low-mass transfer aquifer, and there was trichlor observed over roughly 3 miles of this flow path. And there were limited zones that had lower, limited zones of low hydraulic permeability, high concentration. But we did have a zone that was somewhat more interbedded with lower groundwater velocities in this region. And that required a little more effort than the larger portion of the 3 mile long plume. So the groundwater surface is roughly 100 feet below ground surface, and the aquifer thickness ranges from roughly 50 to 70 feet throughout the plume area. So here's that section I was talking about where we have a zone where we have secondary transport channels, we think. The flows probably range in 1 to 3 feet per day. This is a zone where we had to put more effort per unit area into the restoration than along the primary flow channel where the velocities were up to 10 feet per day. So in the zone where we had the secondary transport channels, we used in situ bio and we used controlled gradient injections to get the reagent across all of the permeabilities. And in the lower mass transfer zone, with the high velocities, we use directed groundwater recirculation where we extract water, clean it, and then re-inject it. And in directed groundwater recirculation, instead of having uncontrolled recharge like we often do in plastic pump and treat, we directed the recharge along the flow pathways to accelerate the advective flushing of those primary channels. So this is a picture that depicts how we handled the controlled gradient reagent distribution. And the problem that we have is where we have conductive pathways with lower K zones interspersed, if we were just doing a standard injection, it would spread out along the higher permeability zones, but it wouldn't perfuse into the lower K zones. So what we set up was three-dimensional injection where we injected up above, and we extracted down below so that we were driving the injected reagent downward through these lower permeability zones. And one thing to point out, these are not solid clay zones that are impermeable. They're simply lower permeability zones that requires a vertical gradient to drive reagent through. So we have a plan view map for this area, and it's roughly 100 acres. And so this indicates areas where we're doing extraction and injection. So the extraction wells out on the outside and the reinjection piped over to the reinjection locations and reinjected as we show with these blue arrows. And then another line down gradient picking up. And so it's injecting at the top, extracting from the bottom, and then there's an upward gradient created by the next extraction well. And then we repeat the downward vertical. So we have a very complex pathway. The objective of this all is to drive our treatment reagent into those lower permeability zones that would be relatively inaccessible to a standard injection or extraction process. So the results here were good. We were able to knock out trichlor in this intensive area where the groundwater velocities were 1 to 3 feet per day. And by 2010, we see the primary transport channel zones are also starting to clean up with the directed groundwater recirculation. By January of 2011, we were down to less than 30 acres of plume footprint above the MCLs. And now the current status as of April of 2013, all of the wells went below MCLs in the first quarter of 2012. The active remedy was shut down in the second quarter of 2012. We've completed a year of post-treatment monitoring and stayed entirely below MCL. And there's one more year of post-treatment monitoring to achieve closure of the site. This is a circumstance where we were able to sufficiently map the transport channels, guide our remedy to sweep out those channels. In the area where the hydraulic connectivities were somewhat lower, it required a more aggressive approach, which we did by a directed gradient or a forced gradient drive of the reagents into the subsurface. So Brian and I have a break built in here for your questions, and we're hopefully gonna have a few questions.
So Fred, this is Brian. Let me just ask you to maybe go back one slide. Can you use your arrow to point at what the size of the zone that you did the reductive dechlorination treatment on?
That zone was roughly right in here, and that was approximately 100 acres.
Right. Good.
Okay, great. Well, just a reminder, this is Jean, and if you're one of our online streaming audio simulcast participants, a number of you have already started typing up your comments or questions. You can continue to do that using the Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. I'm going to start with our first question, and Brian, I believe this one is directed at you. This one came in during your talk. And our particular attendee asks, does matrix storage and back diffusion alter this CSM?
Right. So the conceptual model that I was trying to lay out was really to set the stage for Fred. And basically, on the scale of these plumes, where you start with high concentrations that are in contact with the lower permeability materials, there's always going to be that back diffusion issue and factor built in. And so what we have to do is figure out tractable ways to deal with that. And I know there's a lot of research going on to develop new tools and techniques. So some of those things are going to be coming out of ITRC. I don't know if Fred wants to comment on that.
So there is active research. As you point out, it's going to be addressed in probably a couple ways in the ITRC document, but this is a really rapidly developing area, so I think that all of us are, it's actually a pretty exciting time to be in the industry because there's a lot of change right now with all this research coming out. So stay tuned to the FRTR, stay tuned to the ITRC. Those are a couple of the forums where you'll see information coming out.
Okay. Our next participant, and I'm going to say that I think this is directed to you, Fred, would like to know which software has been used for modeling the dilute plume.
That's a good question because we're not finding the models easy to use at the highly resolved data sets. We're using EDF, the Earth Vision approach, to create these three-dimensional renderings. And so you'll see some of my snapshots, and I think, Brian, you'll probably do this in more detail. So we're visualizing the distributions using EDF. We are interpolating our geology using hydrophases analysis, which is not a mathematical model, but it's more an empirical model of depositional environments. So that's helping us interpolate between our sampling location, and we have to understand the anisotropy and heterogeneities. That's how we do that part of it. But in terms of transport modeling right now, there are some tools available, but they look at the plumes from a very coarse perspective. And so having the data that we have in the very highly resolved data sets is providing, a bit of a challenge for classic groundwater modeling.
Let me weigh in for a second. Basically, what you find, and this is, Fred and I started talking about separating characterization monitoring back in the early 1990s. Our shared belief is that you really need highly resolved information for characterization to help you know where to target things. As you get farther and farther away from the source, while the plume is flowing in kind of a plume core scenario, you know, size and space actually work a little bit to your benefit, and you know, changes in boundary conditions over time, so that you know, there has been some success in using traditional models on large dilute plumes, but they really fall apart in kind of the near to midfield. And so I think this is an area where the active research is going to ultimately give us some new tools. But my current approach is to use existing standard models and then overlay the conceptual model and then try to determine clever ways to parameterize things and understand where the models are going to be weak and not give you diagnostic information.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, let me try to get in just a few more questions while we have some time. Another attendee would like to know if you can sort of talk about the references for the research studies that show that plumes do not disperse laterally. They go on to ask, what about vertical dispersion of the plumes? Wouldn't that also account for some of the, quote, missing mass?
So the references, and by the way, I'll be happy to answer questions by email as well if we need to pass along some specifics. In the book Remediation Hydraulics, we actually have a lot of citations on this issue and go into some depth on it. So that's one reference location. And if you look closely at the slide sets, you could search on the authors. They were showing both vertical and transverse horizontal dispersivities being very, very low. So I think that we do see downward migration of plumes where we have a recharge up above or a pumping from below that's causing plumes to migrate downward, but they're doing it along the highly conductive pathways with relatively low transverse dispersion, either sideways or up and down along those pathways. At least that's the pattern that's emerging where we're getting the highly resolved data. So again, right. References, you can look at the presentation. Search on those names, that'll give you a good start.
Yeah, and let me just add, I think that the actual three-dimensional trajectory of subsurface contamination is a composite of the hydraulic driving forces, the lithology, and the characteristics of the contaminant. And I think we need to be a little cautious. Fred did a really good job showing that theoretically there's not a lot of mixing and dispersion going on. And those were fairly carefully controlled studies where the hydraulic gradients didn't change. So one of the things that happens in the real world is that over three decades that some of these plumes are out there, you'll have hydraulic gradients change. And unless you want to make a model where you capture all of that detail, then what you do is the transverse dispersion is really just a convenient mathematical representation. But you best not make too much out of it, I guess, is the way I would pose it.
Okay. We have one attendee who would like to know, or just kind of comments, that traditional monitoring wells are screened at permeable zones. So they want to know, are they missing most of the mass and sort of underestimating the plume length as a result?
You're not missing the mass during the what we call the leading edge, but you're going to miss a lot of the mass in the trailing edge. So during the time when the plume is first arriving and you have your very high concentrations in the permeable zone, you're not seeing much of the missing mass, but then at later times, as time and diffusion has impacted it, it starts being more and more of an issue.
Okay, great. We have some questions specifically about the Reese Air Force Base site. And so this first one goes on to state that, Fred, you stated you were able to map out the preferential flow channels. Since it was too deep for direct push tools, what did you use to do the high-res sampling that was needed?
And there's also caliche in the upper part, which makes it even more difficult to use direct push tools, even if you could use a real big CPT rig. So really it was constructed by hydrogeologists mapping the old-fashioned way, just basically developing fence diagrams, understanding the site based on its depositional environment, and there were hundreds of well logs available as part of the site characterization and remediation effort. I think just from the sites in the area were added into the hopper to help put together a three-dimensional picture of the hydrogeology. And that was the way that we were able to map the transport channels. And when a location was deemed to be likely in the channel in an area where we needed to get additional pumping capacity, we would construct a well, and that became a hypothesis testing approach to building the conceptual site model. And so ultimately it was done in sort of a more old-fashioned way, because if we were able to use the direct push tools and feed it into EBS, that would have been nice. But in this case, it was more the fence diagram approach, but with an awful lot of wells available to construct that.
Okay. We do have a quick question also asking, what was the injected reagent that you used at Reese?
Primarily carbohydrate. We were driving reductive dechlorination, and so we were using carbohydrates as our electron donor.
Okay. And also another clarifying question about Reese. They'd like to know, when you say that all wells eventually came below the MCLs, do you mean that all the wells in the reductive treatment zone or all wells throughout the plume, including areas that were outside the direct treatment zone? Which one were you referring to?
Yeah, all wells throughout the plume. And my recollection, I may be off on this, but I think there are roughly 70 or 72 monitoring wells that are the compliance network spread along that entire 3-mile zone. And there were two other smaller plumes that were actually already closed that were not part of this 3-mile plume. So two of the three plumes are already closed. The 72, I think it is, monitoring wells along the 3-mile plume, those are the ones that are currently being monitored for post-treatment compliance. But they are spread across the entire 3-mile plume.
Okay. We do have a number of additional questions that have come in, and I see that people are continuing to type them up as I'm speaking right now. But in the interest of time, why don't we carry on with the presentations? But for our attendees, you can keep entering your questions. We do have a second break scheduled before we close out today's session, and we'll kind of revert back and continue through the questions in the queue when we take that next break. So I'm going to go ahead and turn things back to Brian, if you're prepared to share your screen again with us.
I am, and hopefully it'll work smoothly this time.
No problem. And remember, all of the attendees, you can continue to submit your electronic questions and comments, and we'll build up a queue and, again, take a second break before we close out today to try to address more questions.
Okay, well, I'm going to follow on to Fred's talk and emphasize some of those same points, and then talk a little bit about attenuation mechanisms in large and dilute plumes, and try to lead into some additional ideas for cleanup. And I think what you'll find is that in these large and dilute plumes, because they have a footprint that is difficult to address with a single technology, we're really talking about for success, it's going to take some combination or a combined remedy of both source remediation and some kind of plume action. And I think that's what we saw in all of Fred's successes. And it appears to me that as long as the flow is 10 feet per day or more, we'll be able to clean some of these things up based on Fred's data. But I first wanted to pose the question, is mass transfer, is this the final challenge? And for those of you who have been around a while, I looked at the list and I saw Arun on and lots of folks who have been working in this field for a long time. And you'll remember that back in the early 80s, there was this idea that we have these plumes and we'll put in pump and treat and it'll just flush all the stuff out, two or three pore volumes, and it'll be all good. Then in about 89, the DNAPL issue came up. In mid-90s, there was vapor intrusion kinds of things. And now we're really focused on this diffusion and back diffusion. And another way to look at it is what we're really dealing with now is kind of understanding the entire life cycle and the leading and trailing edges of plumes. So I have really a cartoon of the data that was shown. And the real question is, you know, is all lost? Is everything's lost? So we have Fred, who's given the presentation, and we're all just kind of screaming and trying to figure out what's going on. And so what I'd like to do very briefly is talk about what's nice to know, what do we need to know, what's measurable, what's actionable. And so, for example, if we get a site where we had a high concentration source like we have in the middle, and then now that zone has been cleaned, and we see this over and over again, and now your highest concentrations are in clays. And, you know, what we're really talking about, how can we be creative? How can we be thoughtful on cleaning those sites up? So one example, and these are things that we're working on, if the fine-grained materials are going to be a long-term source, target possibly interfaces. So for those sites, consider deployment strategies. And so what we're really saying is start thinking about matching exactly where the contaminant is in the geometry of your remediation system to the geometry of where the contaminant is in the subsurface. And the idea of interfacial reagents is to limit the flux out of those zones and essentially keep the aquifers clean. Let me go up. And then finally, I think we need to work from what is known. So as you learned in our question and answer, we actually don't have a lot of answers on, like, what's a really good model that addresses some of these challenging problems. So what you need to do is make sure your characterization data are actionable. Are we collecting data just so we can make pretty pictures, or are we going to use it to optimize remediation? We need to select and build remediation systems that are robust to the site conditions. So in other words, if we don't actually understand the three-dimensional structure of the plume, can we, in essence, overcome that by the way we deliver and move reagents through the system in the same way that Fred showed the accelerated migration through the system? And I think the most important thing, and it's easy to do this, it's easy to become paralyzed. And so I guess my thought is, let's not be paralyzed by all the stuff we don't know. Because I could sit down with Fred and we could make a list all day of all the stuff we don't know and then say, well, because we don't know all this stuff, we can't clean up. And I guess my bias is let's figure out what we do know and then work with that. So that's kind of my lead in, my transfer from Fred. What I like to do is show a quick video. And this is a large dilute plume, and it's the AM area that we talked about before. There were several sources of solvents. One was a basin. One was a solvent storage tank. There was a leaking process sewer line. There was a little research area over here, and there was an outfall. So three or four major sources of chlorinated solvents. And I'm just going to kind of play this video. And what you can see is that, and I'm going to stop it here in a second. Stop it now. And what you see, and I want to point this out, is that this is a very large area and it's a very thin looking section. You need to be careful because most all the time when you're looking at these three-dimensional representations, there's a lot of vertical exaggeration on it. And these plumes aren't these big fat blobby things. They're actually more shaped like livers where they're thin and aerially extensive. So I'm going to keep playing this. What you can see is we can actually do the vertical exaggeration that people are used to seeing, and I kind of exaggerated the topo on the surface at the same time. And I saw one of the questions was, what GIS information federal databases do we find useful? We find a lot of the topo information, the USGS information on surface water, USGS information on groundwater. We use a lot of a plume from the 5 PPBN. So what you see is this large three-dimensional plume that's being pushed around by the where water enters and leaves the system. So we have this three-dimensional image, and we rotate it because we can. And you can see the well control. So this is 365 wells that were put into this image. And this is just a snapshot. This was from about 1992. And so basically what we have is these data then that we can look at over time as we do our various remediation actions at this site. So basically what we have is that's kind of an intro to M area, and I'm going to come back to that. What we promised before is an assessment of you know, what are attenuation processes in plumes, and are there rates, are the rates of those attenuation processes significant? And I'm going to point out a few references, and I actually don't have them uploaded yet, but I will upload them into the resources for the course. But we have a parametric analysis that we did, and then several papers in the literature. This is just two examples that Ron Falta, Suresh Rao, and others did. And then various lessons that we've learned from REMCLOR, a model that Ron Falta developed, a short course that we just finished with CLUIN. And so what I'm going to do is really do like a one-slide summary of the parametric analysis. And a parametric study is really a mathematical exercise. And what we did, you know, given the fact that Fred has encouraged us to, that there's really not that much dispersion going on, we started simple. And we basically said, let's pretend there's no dispersion going on at all. What would happen to a plume that is undergoing attenuation? And the way I did it really simply. I started with plug flow with sorption as our starting position, and then I just algebraically combined that equation with the equation for first order decay, and I solved it for X. And so basically what you get is X, the size of that a plume gets for any ratio of concentrations, is equal to some kind of a standard relationship between velocity and degradation constant. So you can see that it's really just this ratio of velocity to degradation constant. Now, EPA in their modeling guidance says that you need to assume that the stuff that is sorbed is not degrading. So what happens is that the retardation factor gets left out of this equation, and that's why traditionally when you look at these models, what you get is just the velocity over the first order degradation. Now Ron, being Ron, he did it the other way. He started with the full plume differential equation, and then he simplified down, and then he came to this same equation. And what you can do is you can make a graph, and on the y-axis you have the amount of concentration reduction that you need. So this is just a ratio where this is a hundredth. I need to, let's say I start at 500 ppb and I need to get to 5. Well, I need to get a concentration reduction of a factor of 100, and that's how that axis works. This axis is the size that plume gets to. Now, this is with no dispersion. This is just kind of the plume equilibrating as a plug flow plume. What you can see is that if the ratio of velocity to degradation constant is a very high number, then plumes get big. This is 100 meters. This is 1,000 meters along this axis down here. And so basically what you see is that the size a plume gets to is almost entirely, in first principles, a relation between the amount of concentration reduction that's needed and the ratio of flow rate over attenuation coefficient. So that's really our general approach, and we extended that to look at all different kinds of dispersion cases. And what does all that math tell us? It tells us, once again, the magnitude of concentration reduction is a key determinant of plume size, and so this is how plumes get large. The rate of attenuation process in the plumes strongly impacts the size of the plume. That's that ratio we talked about. It confirmed EPA's preference for degradation process. Degradation is the dominant natural attenuation mechanism, but I would note that any degradation mechanism, both anaerobic, aerobic, or abiotic, can contribute, and we'll talk more about that. Source decay, or the decay of the source over time, and source remediation can reduce plume size, but not as much as you might expect. So if you reduce the plume size, the plume strength by about 90%, you actually only reduce the size of like a 5 ppb contour line after it re-equilibrates by about a factor of a half. So it's about a half as large. Sorption is not a dominant mechanism, particularly since we're assuming that there's no decay going on. There needs probably more research on that. Longitudinal dispersion, I saw this question earlier in the queue. It's not an important attenuation mechanism and often increases plume lengths for the low concentrations. So if you actually use a dispersion model, and Fred cautioned us against that, but if you actually use a dispersion model, longitudinal dispersion is not a good attenuation mechanism to make plumes shorter, and actually often makes them longer. Transverse dispersion can contribute to attenuation, and I would pose if there is a basis for the spreading, like a known change in hydraulic conditions over decades. But that effect is only important for very large plumes, only after plumes get larger than about 1,000 meters, or as they start getting to the size of a mile. So what else does the math tell us? It tells us that large and dilute plumes will achieve a steady state, and it appears to me, based on the research we've done around the country, that a lot of these plumes are either at or approaching a steady state. But those steady state sizes are significantly larger than anaerobic sites because the degradation rates are so much lower. Best case aerobic plumes with weak sources and half-lives of about 10 years, they'll stabilize within about 1,000 meters or so. Worst case aerobic plumes, they have strong sources, half-lives of 30 years or more, they'll stabilize within 5,000 to 10,000 meters, about 3 to 6 miles. The really nice thing is we did these parametric analyses, and what we see is that just those simple calculations correlate very nicely with what is seen in the real world. And that doesn't make the real world challenges any less, but it makes us have some confidence that things are behaving as they should. So what that means is we have to really start understanding what's going on with attenuation in these plumes. And what I did is I put together this timeline of natural attenuation developments, and this is really just a snapshot in time that runs from about 1994 through 2004. And what I've done, just for purposes to make this slide go quicker, I've just color-coded things so that everything that's blue is petroleum hydrocarbons, and everything that's yellow is chlorinated hydrocarbons, and everything that's striped blue and yellow is some kind of a document or directive or guidance that has to do with both petroleum hydrocarbons and chlorinated hydrocarbons. And what you see is that in the early days, there was a lot of success in the petroleum hydrocarbon area. Well, that makes sense because petroleum hydrocarbons are degrading pretty rapidly under natural conditions. What you see is when time came to look at chlorinated solvents, things kind of slowed down and became more nuanced. And the reason there is because geochemical conditions started playing a much larger role in the rate of degradation. And then what you see is the US EPA starts getting their kind of final directives in the 98, 99, 2000 timeframes. So that's really where we are in natural attenuation. But what you find is that the major focus for chlorinated solvents was anaerobic processes. And that was because at that time in the literature, those were the processes that went the fastest, they were easiest to document, and the rates of degradation were similar and on the same order of magnitude as the petroleum hydrocarbon rates. The aerobic degradation rates were so much slower that the kind of first assumption that one would make is, well, they're just so slow, we'll ignore them. Now, what we found over the last two decades or so, though, is that there is literature, and then it's been increasing of late, that there are chlorinated solvent degradation mechanisms in aerobic aquifers. And I'm going to list four and then talk a little more about two of them. Abiotic degradation with reactive mineral phases, and that work, if you want to find it, can be easily found by going to Google Scholar and looking at John Wilson's work, going to the EPA website in Ada, Oklahoma, and other places. The second mechanism is aerobic co-metabolism. Once again, I'll talk more about these. This would be a biological process that breaks down trichloroethylene and other solvents. The leaders in this area are really Hope Lee and her colleagues at PNL and Idaho. Then two areas where I'm not going to go into the details, aerobic direct metabolism, lots of folks and lots of literature on this, but good example, Paul Bradley from USGS. And then hydrolysis has been studied quite a bit. So things like carbon tetrachloride will break down in water by just simple acid and alkaline hydrolysis. And Peter Jeffers, who did a lot of work for EPA and most recently was at SUNY State University of New York in Cortland. And what I'll do is I'm going to quickly just give you a snapshot of both the abiotic and aerobic co-metabolism. Abiotic degradation is reaction with mineral phases, and what you have is reactive iron two minerals such as pyrite and other iron sulfides and iron two carbonates. You have mixed iron minerals such as magnetite, and you have mixed iron and titanium minerals such as ilmenite. And some of this work, this is a great reference that was developed by EPA, and so if you start here and then do science citation, you will find all kinds of things associated with the abiotic degradation. But for a large number of case study sites, there have been significant attenuation documented due to magnetite, the presence of magnetite. Twin City Army Ammunition Plant in Minnesota as an example. And the rates are correlated with relatively inexpensive measurements like magnetic susceptibility. Half-lives of 3 to 6 years have been measured at sites with magnetite present. This is a graph that I assembled, and a lot of this information, we're putting together a white paper for Andrea Leeson and her team at CERTA PSTCP, but this graph is going to be in there. But what we have on this graph is magnetic susceptibility on the x-axis and the quantity of magnetic minerals on the y-axis. And then we've looked at the literature and correlated the quantity of magnetic minerals with the first-order TCE degradation rate. What you can see is the TCE degradation rate is actually on the order of about 10 to the minus 4 times the amount of magnetic minerals. And this is based on a large number of studies and some kinetic work. So what that leads to is we can kind of do an order of magnitude calculation. So what we can do is, based on the preliminary evaluation, we can say abiotic first order degradation coefficients are something like 10 to the minus 4 times the milligrams per kilogram of reactive minerals. Right now, that's primarily magnetite, but we're doing research to see if ilmenite and some other minerals are similarly reactive. And what that means is a first-order decay coefficient in an aquifer containing 0.1% magnetite, which is not unreasonable, would be in the range of 0.1 year to the minus 1, which is about a half-life of 7 years. And this is the kind of thing that folks are seeing in the real world. And what we've done and we'll have in our white paper is tables like this, and what we did is we went down through a large number of minerals, talk about what they are, how they were formed in different depositional settings, what their magnetic properties are, how they'll react on a magnetic susceptibility test, whether they were identified in the EPA report, and whether we think that they are going to be effective in abiotic degradation of chlorinated solvents. Now, that's abiotic. I'm going to switch over real quickly to the aerobic co-metabolism. And what we can see is that aerobic co-metabolism research predates traditional M&A timelines. So here's our 94 through 2004. What we find is back in 1985, John and Barbara Wilson published their paper period here where the focus was really anaerobic. But the really nice thing about aerobic degradation is it doesn't form toxic daughter products, and it maintains a high aesthetic water quality, so the water is nice and crystal clear. So the question becomes, why did virtually all the natural attenuation and bioremediation research for chlorinated solvents shift to anaerobic? And the easy answer is that aerobic processes are much slower, and so active bioremediation is difficult to design and typically not sustainable because the reagents don't stay around, and so you would need to add them for a long period of time. But what's become more interesting of late is to develop ways to estimate aerobic co-metabolism rates in a natural attenuation sense in these large plumes. And one of the things that's helping with that is understanding the co-metabolic process and enzyme activity probes that Hope and her colleagues have developed. So what we have is, in this case, trichloroethylene at the top, and all these data are from University of Minnesota database. And the trichloroethylene is transformed by interaction with various enzymes. And it turns out that methane monooxygenase and toluene monooxygenase and dioxygenase and other oxygenase enzymes are able to co-metabolically break down TCE. The reason is that these enzymes, while the organisms are making it for like aromatic compounds to try to survive, they happen to break TCE down. What happens is once we have this first breakdown step done, then things go pretty easily all the way to carbon dioxide, water, and chloride ion. So that's the idea behind co-metabolism. How do we know that it may be occurring in the environment? Well, HOPE has developed enzyme activity probes, and what we see is that by going through, taking a sample, filtering it, adding in a material that is transformed by the same co-metabolic enzyme into a fluorescent form, allowing a very short period of time, draining it off, and looking at it under a fluorescent microscope, we can count the organisms that, in fact, are making these enzymes. Confirming that, we can look at the DNA using quantitative polymerized chain reaction, and we can look for the little snippets of DNA that code for making these same enzymes. And what we find is that these two methods provide confirmatory and similar information on co-metabolic potential. And then we have data, and this happens to be from Idaho's site, but data from a number of sites that show natural attenuation occurring within plumes at rates that are correlatable with the counts that are obtained using these other methods. Now, what's the hypothesis? Why is this scientifically happening? What's the molecular and microbiological ecology? Why did organisms do this? Why do they do this? And what you find is that in these large aerobic plumes, the reason that the groundwater is aerobic is because there's very low carbon and very low biomass in the plume, but there's always biomass down there in the 10 to the third, 10 to the fourth per mil range in terms of cell counts. And the real question is, what are these guys doing down there and how are they living? They're starving to death down there. And it turns out that what happens, our hypothesis is that some of the energy and carbon for their life is coming from recycling the biomass so that there's a constant kind of recycle going on. But there's no perpetual motion machine going on down there, and so the only other source of material down there is natural organic matter. And so what we believe is happening is natural organic matter at a very slow rate over geologic time frames is slowly being incorporated into this very low biomass down there. And based on this hypothesis and the measurements we've taken around the country, what we see is half-lives of chlorinated solvents, TCE, I should say, in that range of 10 to greater than 40 years, that the process, the natural attenuation process, appears sustainable and is consistent with this expected microbial ecology in these oligotrophic or nutrient-limited systems. And then we also are looking at amendments for application to plumes at the same time.
Brian, this is Jean. Just a quick time check. We're coming right up on 4 p.m.
Okay, I'm going to actually quickly jump through this and get to our conclusion slides. So I'm going to put things together quickly. So one of the things that we've been looking at and we've had a recent training class on, and so we have a lot of experience and feedback from now hundreds of users, but basically we've been looking at the REMCLOR model. The REMCLOR lets you look at the environment in three zones, kind of a near source zone, a mid-plume zone, and a far zone, which is starting to look a lot like our ovals. And it also allows you to do a source remediation. And you can basically change the reaction zones and allow them to vary over time. Now, here's just a simple example of what happens if we make a REMCLOR run and we have a 200 kilogram per release of some solvent at 1,000 micrograms per liter, pore velocity is 60 meters per year. We say it's anaerobic near the source. It's one of these mixed sources, and the remainder is aerobic, and put in the classic half-lives that are from the literature. And then what we have is a conservative, if you make a conservative assumption of no degradation, at 40 years, the plume is 1,000 meters long and is still expanding. That 40 years, if you assume a relatively reasonable half-life of 10 years, the plume is already stabilized, and the plume length is 750 meters. So you can see the plume is still large, but it has stabilized. And it makes a big difference in understanding, you know, what needs to happen in terms of, like, cleaning up this plume and expectations for how long it's going to take to clean up. Now, one of the things that's nice about REMCLOR is it allows you to put in this space-time continuum. It's not really a continuum because it's broken into nine squares. And along the y-axis, you have time, and all along the x-axis, you have distance. So basically between 0 and 400 meters, you put in your rates for that block between 1975 and 2005, and then you might take some active remediation like a reductive dechlorination, and then you might allow natural attenuation. And so you assign different coefficients for each contaminant for each time and space block. Now, it is somewhat limiting, but it allows you to play lots of what-if games and becomes very useful. Here's the input screen that was developed by the CMOS group down at in EPA, and it's pretty awesome, actually. You have your source parameters, all the normal stuff you put in for models. I would point out that it is a advection and dispersion type of model, so you have to be thoughtful about that. But it allows you to separately put in a source remediation and these three time frames so that you can do different combinations of actions within the plume. And just to show how that works and why this is important, here's a plume that Ron did, and this one actually took a fairly large transverse dispersion to match the plume. And the reason is because it was known that this site had water flow directions that varied strongly over time, so they would waggle back and forth in time, and this becomes a way to match that. Is it exactly right? No. Is it practical to do some what-if calculations? It actually is. One of the neat things about RemClor is you can make that middle zone as small as you want, so Ron put in a PRB. So he had a 1 meter thick zone that was a PRB, and what you can see is after 2 years after the PRB is put in, and after you've removed some source, you in essence start seeing the separation of the plume, and then finally the washout. Now, this brings up a really important point. If you take an action at the source, you're not going to see really any effect on the distal portion of that plume until the time for the entire sweep zone, the flushing volume, and until you, in essence, flush the water through the entire plume. So the really nice thing, I like RemClor for doing quick calculations. You clearly need to use more robust models for a lot of sites and most sites. But it allows you to do some thought experiments. One of the really nice things is compared to other analytical solutions, it allows the plume to develop for any number of years before remediation. So you can let the plume develop for 20 years like it sometimes does in the real world before you start remediation. You can simulate these three natural reaction zones. You can separately simulate a source removal. You can remediate all or part of the plume by increasing degradation rates in these different time periods. And the plume responds to all those factors. And I will give a shout out to Gene and Kluin, and you can go back and see all five sessions of the RemClor information. So what are the trends we see? Concentration reduction required to meet interim and final goals is linked to the amount of source remediation removal needed. That's this, how much, what factor of source reduction do you need? The solubility of the source DNAPL strongly impacts remediation. A 90% source reduction typically reduces a plume by about a factor of 2 in size. It has very little effect on the 5 ppb size and a large effect on the 100 ppb plume. And that's because it's a log function. And modeling confirms the value of source remediation, which Fred's case studies also confirmed. And more importantly, the groups, when we did our modeling workshop, they really explored goal setting ideas. And what we found is that the ultimate objective of everyone is to restore the impacted resource and services of that resource, that a binary pass-fail based on a drinking water standard is difficult to achieve soon, and so it may actually discourage cleanup. And so there was a migration toward trying to come up with intermediate goals and ways to declare partial success as people move through the system. So interim mass balance objectives and interim source objectives. Other regulatory constructs may be needed, like natural resource damage assessment. So I'm just simply reporting out from the notes of our course, and the need to apply realistic timeframes. I think that was a really important one for these large dilute plumes. Just arbitrarily saying, you know, I kind of want it to be 30 years, or I kind of want it to be less than 50 years is nice, but and then I'm going to do a quick finish up. Gene, I think I'm still right on my 35 minutes. So I'm going to go back to this MRA example. And when we started, we were going to be done in 30 years because everyone was going to be done in 30 years when they started in 1983. And 2013 is the 30th anniversary, so obviously we're done. And I'll actually show you what's happened. We did 15 years of SVE, soil vapor extraction. We did some thermal, and we did lots of pilot testing at the site. And so here's the site again, and the plume stretches from this operation area as far as you can see underneath the ground into the horizon. This is the 3D plume, and we did groundwater pump and treat. We did a thermal remediation at the source that ran for several years. I'll give you some pounds in a second. We started off in 1985 with a simple first-order mass balance model where we took each of the parts of the subsurface inventory, and we allowed them to move into gas and water by a first-order coefficient, and we removed them with our remediation system by a separately calibrated first-order coefficient. We had 9 years of data. So actually, this was done in 1992, sorry. And so we had 9 years of data, and so we could calibrate this model. What we found, and I'll just point out a couple of things, here's mass on the y-axis for TCE. What you see is TCE is dissolving into the groundwater pretty quickly, and then we turn pump and treat on, and the concentrations go down. What we found is that PCE, tetrachloroethylene, has a lower solubility, and more mass went in, and so it's dissolving into the ground, and then we turned it on, turned on the pump and treat, and we see a slow change. We see a much smaller visible change. And what we found, what we predicted way back in the early part of the remediation, is that in about 2020, we would have a switchover from higher TCE to higher PCE, and it turned out that we've actually switched over just this couple of years ago. So this was a really interesting model because it emphasizes the relative solubility of the solvent and how fast they're going to clean up. And I think the other interesting thing about this is what we see is that PCE right here is extended out over a very long time frame, so it's coming out of the subsurface much slower. That really emphasized the fact that we needed to be more aggressive about our source remediation technology. So we have numbers of thousands of pounds for all of these different technologies, pump and treat, soil vapor extraction, field testing. This is all going to go into a paper we're putting together right now on like 30 years of pump and treat, I guess a celebration. And what we found is that if we do everything in terms of percent removed by the active treatments, we got 100%. We happen to have a pretty good inventory of what went out there. It's still not perfect. But what you see is we only have about 42% of the material out from our active treatments. But if we assume a 40-year half-life, and we believe that it's at 40 years or maybe even a little faster degradation than that, we have an additional 35%. So here at this site, a very large and very complicated plume in a heterogeneous environment, we have about 78% out. And what we have is about 450,000 kilograms from the source area, about 250,000 kilograms from the groundwater, and about 500,000 kilograms from this very large distributed plume. So our conclusion and challenges, well, what's wrong? These things are large and they're dilute. So you can't get your hands on very much of it very easily. Access is relatively expensive. Aerobic processes are slow. It's weak attenuation. They're deep. They're persistent with long tails due to the mass transfer. They require us to clean up source zones and couple those actions with other actions and time. And that any treatment we come up with for the plume is going to have to provide fairly long life performance to be sustainable on the time scale of the plume and be deployable to impact a relatively large area for reasonable cost. And the treatment should avoid large-scale collateral impacts when possible. Now, in terms of opportunities, I believe remediation successes will match technology and deployment site-specific conditions, focus on actionable characterization, set technically based, realistic, and achievable goals, link source treatment to desired impacts in the downgradient plume, combine technologies as needed, as Fred showed, that weak to moderate source strength, high permeability, the presence of reduced iron minerals, the presence of microorganisms that produce oxygenase enzyme, and those type factors increase the potential for success. And there's lots of emerging science. Abiotic processes may be significant at some sites, possibly many. Aerobic co-metabolism is occurring at most sites, but the rates are highly variable. so that the half-lives range over about an order of magnitude. The breadth of work on remediation amendments may lead to enhancement technologies that are viable for.
Andrew, we are about 10 minutes past our scheduled end time. It is currently 4:10 p.m. Eastern. I appreciate everybody who's hung tight with us. If you could wait just a minute or so longer, we'll take one more question now, and then I'll remind people how they can access the materials, submit feedback for today's seminar, as well as provide comments and in future input and access the archived versions of previously recorded seminars. So this last question I'm going to take right now has been submitted online, and this one, I think I'll shoot it to both Fred and Brian. And in this case, we have a participant who comments that your talk focuses primarily on volatile organic compounds, or VOCs. Is there any reason to believe that this pattern of plume behavior applies to other organic contaminants like pentachlorophenol or inorganic contaminants like hexchrome?
This is Brian. I think hexchrome is a good example where you would have the abiotic processes occurring. Pentachlorophenol, you would have to, I would think the, I need to check, but I believe the it depends on the degree of chlorination, and because it's got so many chlorines on it, the co-metabolic rate is pretty slow for that compound, but other chlorophenols should degrade relatively effectively.
Thanks. And what I'll add is other compounds that would match this quite closely would be things like 1,4-dioxane and other compounds that have high solubility and low aerobic decomposition. So it's not restricted just to the volatile organics, but the metals, like Brian was saying, are pretty reactive with the aquifer matrix, and compounds like penta have a fairly high sorption potential relative to the chlorinated solvents. So that's just a quick thumbnail.
Yeah, and Fred, let me just say your point that dioxane has a high solubility. Solubility, I think, is going to be a strong correlator to the potential effectiveness of cleanup. So what we see is as solubility goes down with strong sources and low solubility, that slow bleed from the source is going to be a real challenge at some of these sites.
Okay, great. Thank you. We do have a number of questions that were submitted electronically, and I know we don't have enough time to address them now, but I would encourage the attendees who have outstanding questions to feel free to reach out to either of our presenters. We have their contact information available on the seminar homepage, and you're certainly welcome to reach out and email them after today's seminar. And try to get some of the additional questions answered. And this applies as well for those of you listening to the recording of today's seminar. We usually like to take just a moment to give our speakers a moment to say a few final statements. So, Fred, I'll turn things to you. Any closing thoughts you'd like to share with the audience today?
Well, I think it's a very exciting area to be working in. It is changing, continues to change, and I think some of the research that Brian was talking about, particularly looking at processes that are going on in the lower permeability zones, hold a lot of promise to be carving up these contaminants for us.
Okay, and Brian, any closing thoughts from you?
Yes, I actually forgot to say that, Fred. For example, some of these abiotic processes, the reduced minerals tend to be relatively high in these fine grain zones. So there is some potential that as the research comes out that there'll be data that things that have gone into those zones are breaking down at a relatively higher rate. And then I just want to close with my great appreciation to the FRTR and Navy for asking us and supporting this seminar series, and Jean for her support, because it's been really interesting and exciting, and you know, hopefully it's useful to you guys.
Thank you so very much. Carla, were there any closing thoughts or reminders that you wanted to provide the audience with?
Yes, I did want to also say to both Dr. Looney and Dr. Payne, on behalf of FRTR, thank you very much. We're very grateful for your willingness to share this information and the time that you've spent. It's really exciting that we can get this kind of information out to such a wide audience, and we really do appreciate that. And for everyone on the phone, I thank you for participating. I'm hopeful you've learned some good information today. And perhaps you have a new understanding of your groundwater plumes and some new tools and strategies to think about and apply. So I also want to remind you that you can go to FRTR for some more information on various topics. Go to the website as well as to go back to the CLUIN website here to download the presentations. And we will be looking for your comments to follow up and follow up on any questions. So thank you very much.
Great. Thank you so much. All right. With that, let me go ahead and officially start the closeout procedures for today's Internet seminar. I also want to echo the thanks. We had nearly 350 people who signed up and joined us for today's live broadcast. You continued to sign up literally right until we started the seminar. So I'm glad we had such a great turnout for today's session. If you're looking to download a copy of today's materials, all of that information can be found on the additional resources. A new window will open up allowing you to download copies of the presentation materials from today. I would ask if you could take just a short moment to fill out our feedback form. That's also available off the seminar homepage and shows up under the related URLs. I do read each and every one of their responses, and I welcome to hear your thoughts on our delivery mechanism as well as the content that we presented today. If you shared the line with multiple parties at your location, each individual person can submit their own feedback form. Once the first person fills it out, there'll be a link that will appear to allow another person to hop on and submit their own feedback. If you don't have access to a computer with internet right now, that's okay. That feedback form is active from this point forward. So you can certainly refer back to your registration emails to get to that seminar homepage and fill out the feedback later on if you need to. This also applies to those of you watching the recorded version of today's seminar. You too can still submit feedback after the live delivery by following the links available in the archived version. For those of you looking for credits or certificates for your attendance in today's seminar, we don't necessarily issue like CEUs or PDHs for our seminars, but many of our attendees are able to earn credit. If you save your registration email, you download a copy of the presentation materials, and you fill out the feedback form with paying careful attention to check a box that offers you an option to request a confirmation email. As long as your email address is entered correctly on that form, we will send you a confirmation message via email after you submit feedback, which at least verifies that you gave us feedback after the live delivery. So if you couple that with the other resources I just mentioned, you'll usually be able to earn credit from your training officer or accrediting institution. Again, thank you all so very much for joining us. I do apologize for running a little bit long today, but hopefully the several hundred of you who stuck through that extra time with us found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. Thank you all, and again, you will receive an automatic email once this recording is available. You can feel free to circulate that to anyone you think that will find it valuable.